Paul's letter to the Galatians is a little bit different from the other letters that he writes, primarily because it's going to a group of churches instead of a single church. That in itself has presented problems down through the years from so-called biblical scholars. I'm going to tell you this morning what the scholars debate back and forth. Then I'm going to tell you what Bob Ward thinks about it. I'm no better than they are. But the problem that we have, or problem that we want to make for ourselves, and really the bottom line is, we create problems for ourselves when we try to be smarter than what the Bible tells us. Anytime we go beyond what the Bible tells us or try to figure out what Paul is trying to say or what the Lord is trying to say through Paul, then we run into problems. And that's why I'll tell you what the scholars say, and then we'll take a look at what Bob Ward has to say about it. In the handout, Stan starts off with what he calls metadata. Anybody know what metadata means? It's a relatively new term, 25 or so years back. But it's data that provides information about other data. So we're going to look at the metadata this morning to try to figure out who the Galatians are that Paul is writing to. Three important questions surround the book of Galatians. First of all, who is the Galatians? Secondly, when was the letter written? And third, why was the letter written? We could ask a fourth one, but really it's not material. Who wrote the book? The Apostle Paul is identified as the author in Galatians 1 and verse 1, and again in chapter 5 and verse 2. Even the most critical biblical scholars say that Paul actually wrote it. So that the fourth question is really a moot point. But we're going to look at who were the Galatians, when was the letter written, and why was the letter written, before we actually get into the letter itself. Who were the Galatians? Anybody? Do what?
Gaul.
Gaul, right behind the bladder. Gaul. That's an old joke. The Gauls came into Asia Minor back in the 3rd century BC. And they were a warlike people, and they were looking to grab what they could. So they moved into Asia Minor and began to fight, and some of them settled down in Asia Minor. The Gauls are actually made up of European nations like the French, the Irish, the Scottish, the Welsh. All of them mixed together come into Asia Minor and began to try to confiscate property, loot, pillage. And like I say, they settled down there. But about 100 years later, the Roman Empire conquered them. About 186 or something BC, the Roman Empire conquered that region of territory and even captured the Gauls. The problem, our part of the situation, was very much like Rome did to Israel. When Rome took over Palestine, they allowed the Jews to rule themselves. And they did the same thing with Gaul, or with Galatia. They allowed the Celtic nations to rule themselves. And this continued up until 25 BC, and after 25 BC, Rome actually took over the territory. So when the Apostle Paul went on his first missionary journey, and he went through southern Galatia, he was actually talking to churches that belonged to the Roman Empire, or he was creating churches in areas that belonged to the Roman Empire. The question came about, or has come about, from biblical scholars. Well, when Paul was writing this letter, what churches was he talking about? And some of the scholars want to say that he was talking to the northern Galatia people themselves. Galatia has a dual meaning. Galatia is political, and it's also regional. And it depends upon which way you want to go with the study as to who Paul was writing to. Many will accept the northern churches. And by the way, brethren, someone show me where these northern churches are identified. In the handout, Stan lists labels the unsettled question, did Paul address his letter to ethnic Galatians, which were the Gauls of northern Galatia, and he mentions three different cities, Ancyra, Pessinus, and Tavium. Now actually these three cities were cities that were capital cities in different divisions of Galatia. Nowhere in the Bible can you find where a church was established in any of them. And yet, the scholars that want to accept the letter is going to the northern churches will list these churches as being who the letter went to. That's known as the North Galatia theory. Conversely to the North Galatian theory is the Southern Galatian theory. And this includes the churches at Antioch, Lystra, Derbe, and Iconium. Now we know Paul, on his first missionary journey with Barnabas, went into these churches, or went into these cities and established churches. We don't have any record of him going into the northern cities and establishing churches. We have records of him passing through there. Both the book of Acts will say something about him going through Galatia and Phrygia, but no one mentions any of the cities No one mentions any churches being established. We don't know how long Paul traversed the area, but we do know that he did go through it. But no, again, no churches. Whereas in the southern churches of Antioch, Lystra, Derbe, and Iconium, we know that he did establish churches. And the question is, who was he writing to? With that confused explanation, confusing to me anyway, who are you going to say that he wrote the churches, or wrote to? What does Galatians 1 verse 2 say? What does Galatians 1 2 say? Anyone?
And all the brethren which are with me unto the churches of Galatia.
Unto the churches of Galatia. Do we need anything else? We don't need it. Paul wrote to the churches of Galatia. If we let the Bible teach, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, the Bible is its own best commentary. If we accept what the Bible says and realize that he wrote to the churches at Galatia, that settles it. When John was writing his... Gene?
Well, I have a question. What is the advantage of the people that are trying to say he wrote to northern Galatia? What does that profit them if they can make that point? I don't get it.
Well, really, the North Galatian theory was established years ago. I mean, it was one of the first theories that came about because archaeology finds had not been not concluded that the four churches that we mentioned in the south were actually in Galatia. And it wasn't until I think in the 19th century, W.M. Ramsey did archaeology studies and found that they were truly Galatian churches. So their concept was that it had to been the area up north that was truly identified as Galatia and not south. When Rome incorporated the whole area of Asia Minor, it included both the north and the south. But like I was going to say, you go over to the book of Revelation and read the writings of John. The Lord told John to write to the seven churches of Asia. And he identified it. He identified the churches that he wanted. And there was a specific reason, I think, as to why he wanted the churches identified. And that was because there was problems in the churches and he wanted them identified as problem churches. So the Lord told John, you'll identify the churches. Here, to the Apostle Paul, he doesn't make that request. Paul, writing under through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, simply said to the churches of Galatia, north, south, it doesn't matter. The reason that where it went to could present a problem with the dating of the letter. If he wrote after the first missionary journey, which was what, 44, 46 AD, something like that, then it would make the Letter to the Galatians, one of the earliest letters that was ever written. If he waited until after the second and third missionary journey, when he did travel through the northern area, if he did establish churches, and again, there's no evidence that he did, it would be a much later date. Irregardless, from the time of the first missionary journey until the time of the last missionary journey, you've got something like 10 to 12 years that could be the time of the writing. Again, it's immaterial. It's immaterial. So who were the Galatians? They were the Gauls, as Jerry pointed out a moment ago. When was the letter written? We've got that 10 or 12 year window in there that it could fall into. The third major question is, why was the letter written? Why was it? Okay, show that man is justified by faith and not by
works of the law.
Works of the law. Many commentators refer to the letter to the Galatians as the Magna Carta of the Christian faith. And it's simply because of that. Paul is attempting to show that we're justified by faith and not by works of the law. Why is that so important?
The churches of Galatia were troubled by the Judaizers. You were saying that Christians, or specifically Gentiles, had to keep aspects of the old law to be saved, the law of Moses.
Okay. And everywhere Paul went, it didn't make any difference whether it was, the Judaizing teachers came in behind him and tried to teach false doctrine. Isn't that why he had to go to Jerusalem in Acts 15? To get that little matter straightened out? Because the Judaizing teachers, as Brett indicated, wanted Gentile Christians to keep portions of the law. Primarily circumcision as an outward sign, and Paul addresses that elsewhere. But the Judaizing teachers were responsible for why they had come in behind the Apostle Paul, and apparently in a very short time after Paul had left there, and tried to destroy what Paul had done. They had to do that, first of all, by destroying the apostleship of Paul. We see that in the political arena today. If you can't argue against the stand that a person has taken, then you destroy the character of the individual. And if you destroy the character of the individual, then their argument is moot anyway. So that's what the apostle was running into. He established the churches. He established them based on truth. And the Judaizing teachers came in and tried to destroy that. A couple of quotes I want to give you. About the character of the Gauls. One is from Julius Caesar. And Julius Caesar says the infirmity of the Gauls is that they are fickle in their resolves and fond of change and not to be trusted. Another scholar says frank, impetuous, impressible, eminently intelligent, but at the same time extremely changeable, inconsistent, fond of show, perpetually quarreling, the fruit of excessive vanity. Now, how does the Apostle Paul describe it? Look down in verse 6. Verse 6 and following, he says, I marvel that you are turning away so soon. This indicates the brevity in which the Judaizers got to them. That you're turning away so soon from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel, which is not another, but there are some who trouble you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you than what we have preached to you, let him be accursed. As we have said before, so now I say again, if anyone preaches any other gospel to you than what you have received, let him be accursed. So they were a fickle people. They were changeable. And that's one of the reasons the Apostle Paul wrote to them, because they were changing. And they were changing very soon after he had established the churches. Questions or comments?
One comment I mentioned once before is an extremely strong language, be accursed. And I was trying to examine that, and only against the righteousness of Christ could you validate that being accursed.
Okay. Anyone else? Come on, y'all. Okay, so they were a fickle people. Paul wrote to them to indicate that they were in error to follow after the Judaizing teachers. Now let's take a look at an outline of the book. In chapter 1, verses 1 through 10, we've got an introduction. One of the unusual things, or at least I think it's a strong argument in favor of the Apostle Paul. The Judaizing teachers tried to destroy his credibility by saying that he's not an apostle. In his salutation, he begins his defense of being an apostle. Notice, Paul and an apostle, where did it come from, Paul? Where did the apostleship come from?
Christ.
Do what?
Christ.
It came from Christ. It's not from men, nor through men, but Jesus Christ and God the Father who raised him from the dead. He starts off, and in his other letters he identifies himself as an apostle of God the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. But here, he's saying, I'm an apostle, because of them and not because of man. It's easy for some people, and apparently it was easy for the Galatians, to pick up on, because of their fickleness, to pick upon what the Judaizing teachers came in to say. Throughout the rest of the letter, Paul is going to illustrate what his apostleship means. This is probably, how would you say, a bibliography of the Apostle Paul. There's a large part of the life of the Apostle Paul after his conversion that is identified in the book of Galatians. But he is an apostle by divine origin. Beginning in verse 11. But I make known to you, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man. Where did the Judaizing teachers' doctrine come from?
Man.
It came from man. But the gospel that I preached didn't come from man. And it continues. Verse 12, for I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it, but it came through the revelation of Jesus Christ. That revelation began when Saul of Tarsus was on the road to Damascus. And he goes on to explain how the Lord instructed him through this revelation. For you have heard of my former conduct in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God beyond measure and tried to destroy it, and I advanced in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries in my own nation, being more exceedingly zealous for the traditions of my fathers. But when it pleased God, who separated me from my mother's womb and called me through His grace to reveal His Son in me, that I might preach Him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately confer with flesh and blood, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went to Arabia and returned again to Damascus. There was no way that Paul could learn what he was teaching from man. It had to come from the Lord Himself. He made himself unavailable so that he could receive the instructions of the Lord. What was Paul's relationship with the other apostles?
Very little.
How so, Mark?
He, up until, well, there's no real recorded instances of his interaction with the other apostles, except for one interaction with James and one interaction with Peter. And that's all that we ever have recorded in the entire Bible. So even though he came back to Jerusalem, that was after the dispersion of the apostles, so he didn't have any action on his last visit back to Jerusalem that we're made aware of.
Okay.
And so, I mean, it's practically speaking, there's no... The only other occasion that he had any interaction would have been with the
And it was when he and Barnabas were sent down from the church in Antioch to address the questions regarding circumcision and whatnot.
Okay. As recorded in 15th chapter of Acts.
And after his conversion, he was in Arabia. What was it, 3 years?
2 or 3 years, yes.
The other apostles at the time of his conversion were still in Jerusalem. And before then, any relationship he had had with them would have been antagonistic because he was persecuted violently. He used the word violently in persecuting the Church of God. I don't know if he had personal interaction during that time, but if it would have been, it wouldn't have gone well.
Well, he even says here, I tried to destroy the church. Destroy the church, you're going to destroy the apostles, you're going to destroy the membership. He was in good conscience when he thought he was doing what God wanted him to do. And it, I don't know how he would have reacted with the other apostles either. Okay, so you got the defense of his apostleship in Galatians 1 and 2, both chapters 1 and 2. Then in beginning in chapter 3 and through chapter 4, you get Paul's defense of the gospel of justification by faith, as Brett mentioned a moment ago. This is what Paul is trying to do with the letter to the Galatians. First of all, in chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, he gives a personal argument. Beginning in verse 6 of chapter 3 and going down through verse 25, a spiritual argument. And then in verse 26 on into chapter 4 and verse 7, a practical argument. And then a sentimental argument. And finally, 4:21 through 31, the allegorical argument. So Paul isn't basing it upon just one argument. He's given everything that anything and everything that he can to jack up the Galatians to see where the era that they're trying to espouse at this time. It's wrong. Any questions or comments so far? Yeah?
In chapter 4, chapter 4, and verse 5, I think it's very powerful in what it says. It says, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of the sons.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. So we got his defense of his apostleship, defense of the gospel of justification by faith, and finally, he closes out the last couple of chapters, and by the way, there's only 6 chapters in the letter. It's a call to stand fast in the liberty of the gospel. That is a basic outline of this short letter. Now, Stan, in his handout, has a little bit more concise outline than what I've just described. But you can study that on your own. again, his purpose for writing. And by the way, there's an error there on the handout. Paul's purpose in writing 2 Corinthians, cross out 2 Corinthians and change that to Galatians. I should have told you that to start with. His letters are authoritative, a rather severe denunciation of Judaizing doctrine. The doctrine was leading the Galatians into apostasy. The letter consists primarily of a denunciation of the contention that justification can be obtained through the law. Again, any questions or comments? Okay. Several important questions that are passages that can be memorized to better benefit our study of the book of Galatians. Over on the third page of the handout, beginning with difficult passages. The first difficult passage that we're going to discuss is found in chapter 2 and verse 6. Verse 6 says, "But from those who seem to be something, whatever they were, it makes no difference to me. God shows personal favoritism to no man, for those who seemed to be something added nothing to me." So the difficult passage that we want to look at, God shows no personal favoritism to no man. What does that do to Calvinism? It sure does. You know, you've got the term tulip that describes the different tenets of Calvinism, and if you can destroy any one of them, you destroy the whole thing. Calvinism says that God has already selected who is going to be saved, who's going to be condemned. It doesn't make any difference what you do in your life. You're not going to be able to change what God has already established. If God has already selected the ones that are going to be saved individually, and I know that he's talking, when he talks about predestination, it's God's plan for a select group of people and not individuals. But if he was an individual, as Calvinists like to claim, what does that do as far as God showing favoritism to one individual over another individual?
He's picking his team.
Do what?
He's picking his team. It's like on the schoolyard. You want this one, but not that one. You want this one, but not that one.
Okay. We run into problems, and by the way, in different terms, the idea of God showing no personal favoritism or God is not a respecter of man appears something like 5 or 6 times throughout the entire Bible. Old Testament and New Testament. God selected Abraham to be the father of nations. Isn't that an example of him showing favoritism?
Why he was chosen.
Do what?
Was why he was called a righteous man.
Okay. Gene?
There was law for the rest of the world. The Jewish nation was chosen by Christ to save the world, but there was law. There was, God didn't abandon the rest of the world just because he chose the Jewish nation as his people.
Okay. Good point. The first example of law, God's law, is the patriarchal law. And just because God chose Abraham because of his faith to be a father of nations, and actually through Abraham bring us Christ, doesn't mean that he was showing favoritism to Abraham. Josh?
The point to be made on that side, all the nations did not come from Abraham. There were other nations pre-existing and nations that came out of those nations. He wasn't the only person to have nations come from.
Okay. Anyone else?
Abraham was used to benefit all of humanity.
That's right. And as Gene pointed out a moment ago, and as Paul is going to discuss here in this letter to the Galatians, his plan was to bring Christ to mankind, to redeem man, something that under the old law or under the patriarchal law, man couldn't do. Man couldn't be justified or redeemed to God through the blood of sacrifices other than the sacrifice of his son. So, God isn't showing personal favoritism to no man by selecting Abraham. What about Cornelius? What about Cornelius?
Cornelius was used to show the Jews that the Gentiles were acceptable candidates for salvation through Christ. So again, there's a benefit there for the Gentiles. He was a righteous man. He was searching for truth. And the Lord has promised those who search for truth will find it. And again, he was used for the Jews so they would be convinced that the Gentiles were candidates for the gospel.
I go back to what Gene said, and to combine with what you say, Brett, is that there was law unto man. Now, today, can someone pray to God who is not a child of God? No.
You can, it doesn't mean that you're hurt.
Well, all right. But the point is, you have to be a child of God in order to talk to your Father.
And along the point of God really didn't show any personal favoritism, because in the wilderness, I kind of remember if it was towards the beginning or the end or somewhere in the middle, when the Israelites rebelled, God was like, okay, I'm done with these. Moses, we're starting over with you. Okay. There was no favoritism personally. It was who was acting the best at the time.
But to get back to Cornelius. Cornelius, as Gene pointed out, there was law of God outside of Judaism. There were people who followed after God, continuing, so far as I know, the patriarchal law. And that's where that's where Cornelius would fall into. God wasn't showing partiality to him. As Brett pointed out, he was using another devout individual, just like Abraham, to spread the gospel to the Gentiles. Any questions or comments? Okay, we just got a minute or two. Let's just go ahead and we'll end it right there with the first difficult passage being done, and Stan can pick up there if he wants to or go back through it. Next week, I appreciate the comments of everyone. Good study.